Hi everyone, welcome to Baby Steps Nutrition, a podcast that focuses on nutrition, health, and wellness for families of children of all ages and stages. I'm your host, Argavon Neil Forouche, a pediatric dietitian and mom of two young children. My goal is to bring you impactful information that you can apply every day in a simplified, practical form to make life easier. Now let's get into today's conversation. People often look to nutrition research to help them make important decisions about their health. What should I eat? What do I avoid? How can I best improve my quality of life and those of my loved ones? In the past 30 years, there has been a tremendous increase in research on diet and health. How can information from those studies be used to make health recommendations when so many factors are involved? Melissa Milot is a registered dietitian and research scientist at Seattle Children's Research Institute in Seattle, Washington. She completed her dietetic internship at Yale New Haven Hospital in Connecticut and her Doctor of Philosophy in Nutritional Sciences at the University of Connecticut. She has previously worked at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and University of Connecticut in research. As a nutritional epidemiologist, her passion is understanding the interrelationships of diet, environmental exposures, and health outcomes. Hi, Melissa. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's really great to be on your podcast today.
Today's conversation is one I particularly love because it bridges the gap between nutrition research and practical implementations of healthy habits. So let's get right into it.
Sounds good.
So would you mind sharing with us what is a nutritional epidemiologist and what has been your journey to be here?
Sure. Yeah. So briefly, that term nutritional epidemiologist means that I'm looking to understand the factors that influence health and disease. And specifically, I take a look at those nutritional factors that influence our health. And so I've been interested in nutrition for a very long time, knew that I wanted to get my bachelor's degree in nutrition and then become a registered dietitian. And then after my dietetic internship, my first job as a dietitian was actually working in research. And so I worked at Johns Hopkins, where I was able to take part in a lot of different clinical research studies, lending my, you know, nutritional expertise to them. So sometimes I was helping to design nutrition-related studies or collect dietary data from participants in studies or help carry out an intervention. So possibly, you know, doing some nutrition counseling with research participants to evaluate what types of approaches worked best, or delivering a nutrition intervention like a nutrition supplement for participants involved in a study. So I loved being involved in such a broad range of studies with a broad range of outcomes, you know, looking at different patient populations, those who needed to lose weight or those struggling with a chronic illness. And I just loved that work and was really inspired to go and get my PhD so that I could take a little bit more of a leadership role in designing and leading my own research. So that's what led me to the University of Connecticut, where I got my PhD in nutritional epidemiology. And so my research there looked at nutritional influences on several different chronic diseases, cancer outcomes, in addition to, weight status and obesity risk in children, and a few other things. So I really got some great experience there, looking at a broad range of applications for nutritional epidemiology. And I also, during that time, became really interested in looking at how, like you mentioned, diet intersects with our environment. And I was really interested in how different environmental chemicals make their way into our diet and how we're exposed to them just through the foods that we eat every day. So I was really intrigued by that and decided to, you know, in my next role, which I'm currently at Seattle Children's Research Institute, I'm looking at a lot of environmental chemicals and how those affect our health. So in this role, I'm getting to, you know, blend my interests in nutrition and environmental chemicals, and specifically looking at how those are impacting children's health, since we specifically study children in a lot of our work.
It's amazing. And you've covered such important topics, actually all the key topics, all the questions that dietitians often have, and you've actually researched them. So I'm excited to speak about some of those most recently, the publications that you've done. Given your experience, your knowledge, why is the interplay between diet and environment important to look at, especially when it comes to a child's behavior and development?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think sometimes this relationship is really overlooked. We, you know, scientists often are very siloed. So we look at one thing at a time, or we have one focus without looking at those, you know, complex relationships that are really going on. So to answer your question, diet can be one of the most important routes of exposure to many environmental chemicals. So I don't think we can look at them separately, look at diet without considering the environmental contaminants of our diets, or look at our exposure to these chemicals without thinking about diet. So there are a number of ways that we are exposed to some harmful chemicals from the environment, like in our households, certain, you know, textiles, or, you know, flame retardant textiles in our homes, or flooring materials, or even the things we put on our skin, like personal care products, and even just inhaling some of the dust in our homes can be ways that we're exposed to some potentially harmful chemicals. But diet is one of the main routes that we can be exposed to certain chemicals. So for example, there are some chemicals called phthalates, which are chemicals that help make plastics durable and flexible. And for some phthalate chemicals, our diet is a source of probably over 90% of our exposure. So it's really important that we're thinking about diet when we want to think about, you know, the implications of those exposures. So that's why I think we really need to take a look at these environment and diet exposures together. To build on that example of phthalates, it's really important that we're thinking about those in terms of our health, because we have evidence that certain phthalates are linked with insulin resistance, which can be associated with diabetes, also with blood pressure. And these phthalates can also contribute to some reproductive problems. So earlier menopause or low birth weight of babies and preterm birth. So there's a lot of important reasons that we should be looking at these chemicals and how we could be exposed to them in our diets. And you also asked specifically about children. So I think children are a key and vulnerable group that we should be looking at. Mm-hmm. They often have higher exposure to some of these chemicals than adults. They have more what we call hand-to-mouth behavior. So they're picking up toys, or they're crawling on the floor, putting their hands in their mouths. So they tend to have a lot more exposure to some of these harmful chemicals. And compounding that, they're at a vulnerable stage of development where their, you know, organ systems are still developing and could be at, you know, higher risk when they're exposed to these chemicals than adults. So I've been really fortunate to be able to participate in some pediatric research.
And it's astounding how early the exposure begins. So we used to think when the child was born, and as you said, crawling and putting things in their mouth. But now, as you know, the studies go back to the maternal transmission in utero and through breast milk.
Yes, you're right. Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. It's true. It starts, you know, earlier than birth. We know that a lot of things are transferred through the placenta to the growing baby, and also in breast milk, that a lot of these chemicals are found in breast milk and transferred to babies at those very young ages.
And so this is why I'm so appreciative of the work that you do, because it's bringing that awareness. I know a lot of the times moms find out they're pregnant, you know, a few weeks in or a little bit later, but if we can have that education, have that awareness, even preconception, I think this is where it's important to start making those changes to reduce the toxins. I know we can't ever do them 100% as much as we'd love to, but as much as possible and do our best.
Yeah, exactly. I think there are some, you know, small steps, and everyone can, you know, choose for themselves which steps are reasonable and that they can implement in their lives. And I always preach, you know, to not take an all or nothing approach, to adopt the healthy changes that you can.
Yes, life is already stressful as it is, right?
Yes.
You know, I follow you on Twitter, and there was one post that you made that really stood out for me, and it was an article that you referenced, and it talked about how we as a society have bought a whole lot of high-cost nonsense about diet and science alike. Why did that resonate with you?
I think what you're referring, this is an article, by David Katz, who, is a physician, and he founded, Yale University's Yale Griffin Prevention Research Center. So it's a center, really focused on prevention of chronic disease. And so, as we know, nutrition is, an important part of that. And so he wrote this article, really talking about how, you know, today we often have this temptation to look at one nutrient or one food group as a scapegoat. So that's, you know, sometimes sugar or meat or carbohydrates or saturated fat. And we try to, you know, reduce nutrition science down to one thing or another, that if you would just eat more of this or, you know, completely exclude it from your diet, then that's, then you'd be fine. And obviously, for each of these things that I mentioned, like sugar or meat products, in excess, certainly they can be dangerous to our health, but they also can be reasonably added as part of a healthy diet in moderation. And so I think Dr. Katz's philosophy that he was promoting in this article, and that really resonates with my philosophy around nutrition, is a fairly common sense approach of sticking to, you know, a lot of the foundational principles that we know of prioritizing nutrient-dense foods, often including plant-based foods like our vegetables and fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds. Also drinking mostly water and limiting those foods that we know are not really, you know, doing anything to help our health, like sweets and other types of snack foods that add calories, but not a lot of nutrition. So that really mirrored my overall approach to, you know, how I think we should be looking at our nutrition, is, you know, not always getting caught up in the latest superfoods or, yes, or fads, but, you know, sticking to what we know. And certainly there are still, you know, questions that nutrition researchers need to be addressing. We don't have it all figured out. It can be a little more complicated and nuanced than just that common sense approach. But I think most people, if they just do stick to that sort of common sense approach, they're going to be fine. So I don't like to, you know, stir up any fear in my research. I like to, you know, just remind people of those basics over and over again.
Yes. And this goes hand in hand with an interview I did with Dr. Marian Nessel. And we also talked about this term superfoods. And so, you know, I know as a society, we like to complicate things. We like trends, we like fads, we like things that make the headline news, but it goes back to the basics, as you said, right? We want to focus on fiber. We want to focus on nutrient density. We want to focus on food diversity.
Yes. Yes. And those things don't make a lot of great headlines or make anybody a lot of money, but you know, that's really the basis of it. I think that's the basis of a very smart and sound diet.
So true. Let's get into your publications. You've certainly had many and they're all amazing. I mean, I've gotten through a couple of them and there are some other ones that I have on my list to still look at. You recently published a study about the maternal vitamin D status during pregnancy and how that impacts a child's IQ when they're between the ages of 4 to 6 years. I'd love if you can tell our audience about that and the goal or outcome that will be applied when it comes to screening and supplementation.
Yeah, I would love to share more about that. So as we talked about, you know, early in development, when a mother is pregnant, a lot of things are going on in the development of that baby. So, you know, the child's health starts, you know, pre-birth. And so vitamin D is one interesting nutrient that can influence a child's development during that early period of pregnancy. And we do have evidence, you know, from animal studies that the receptor for vitamin D is expressed on the fetal brain as early as 12 days into gestation. So we know that vitamin D is going to that developing fetus's brain early on and playing some important roles there. And so we wanted to look at, you know, how the vitamin D status in pregnancy relates to the long-term trajectory of a child's brain development, because those, you know, that early foundational development may have consequences over the long term. And as you probably know, vitamin D is one of the most common nutrient deficiencies that we see in the overall population. So we used data from a cohort study called CANDLE, or the Conditions Affecting Neurocognitive Development and Learning in Early Childhood. So this is a cohort that recruited pregnant women and then has followed up the health of their children over many years. So these children are in middle childhood currently. And so we were able to gather data on the mom's vitamin D status during pregnancy, and we have monitored the neurodevelopment of children over time. So we have IQ scores at age 4 to 6. And we did see, as you alluded to, that there was this positive relationship between the vitamin D status and IQ, suggesting that the higher vitamin D promoted better neurodevelopment of children. And so I think the implications of this are that, especially for women who may be at risk for vitamin D deficiency, we should definitely be screening for deficiency, identifying those women who are at risk, and potentially starting some supplementation to help reverse any deficiencies. A lot of pregnant women are taking prenatal supplements, but if you went into pregnancy already deficient in vitamin D, the amount of vitamin D that's in your prenatal supplement is not likely going to be enough to help really replete your vitamin D status. So I think we really need to be looking out for those women who are at risk and making sure that we supplement appropriately to bring up their vitamin D status.
Yes, because it also depends on, and you mentioned a lot of these factors, right? It could be maternal age, it could be your status, it could be the time of year where you're pregnant, it could be pigmentation that affects how much vitamin D is stored and that you get from the sun, and most people are not getting enough outdoor exposure. So yes, it's interesting that your study shows that it's as early as 12 days, which most people don't even know that they're pregnant.
Exactly. Yeah. So really, it would be great if we could just prevent vitamin D deficiencies, for people who may be thinking about becoming pregnant or could possibly become pregnant. And one thing I want to circle back to is that you noted skin pigmentation is an important risk factor for vitamin D deficiency. We have data from national surveys that shows us that about 80% of Black pregnant women in the U.S. are deficient in vitamin D. And this is 2 to 3 times the rate that's seen in white pregnant women. And it's because the melanin in the skin helps protect against UV damage, but also that UV radiation is needed for the skin to produce vitamin D. So for a lot of us, that production of vitamin D in our skin is the main way that we get our vitamin D supply, since it can be difficult to get from our diets. So definitely, this is an important population that we need to be thinking about the consequences of vitamin D deficiency for.
And that's quite profound. So 8 out of 10. So I would imagine, or I would hope, that the OBGYNs, just assuming that your patient is probably vitamin D deficient, and making sure that your patient is tested and ample yes. supplementation to support a healthy pregnancy and exactly. onward.
Exactly. That is exactly our hope from this, is that we can raise awareness among OBGYNs or other, you know, primary care providers who know that their patient may be thinking about becoming pregnant.
Wonderful. What are your thoughts on the dietary guidelines for Americans and other public health measures for food and nutrition? I know there are so many messages out there and people see these guidelines and they don't know what to do with it. Any caveats, or what's your opinion?
Yeah, good question. And I think I'll circle back to what we were discussing before about fairly common sense approaches to nutrition. So I think that the dietary guidelines for Americans do mirror those common sense recommendations fairly well, of promoting more fruits and vegetables, making sure that those cover half of your plate, making half of your grains from whole grain sources. So I think a lot of that is really sound advice. I think it obviously can be very confusing when there's so many messages out there, and there are so many, facets of the dietary guidelines for Americans. There's a lot to digest there, so to speak, when people look at those messages and all that's contained within the guidelines. So definitely, I think for people who have any specific health concerns, it's great to work with a dietitian to make sure you know how to implement those guidelines for your own health needs. But generally, I think, the dietary guidelines are a great starting point. And there are certainly some things that I hope that future iterations of the guidelines can maybe do a better job addressing. Mm-hmm. And one that comes to mind is really the cultural competence and, the diversity that's represented in them. For example, when we look at the MyPlate model, which shows us a quarter of our plate should be vegetables, a quarter should be fruits, we should have, a meat and a grain portion and dairy on the side. That is not how everyone eats. I don't eat that way. A lot of us don't. So I hope that future iterations, take the next steps of translating that into, some practical, other pyramids and recipes or shopping guides for how that, can be implemented for a lot of different diverse populations. So that's kind of, one thing I'm really hoping to see in future iterations to make those, guidelines more practical for people to follow.
Yes, it's certainly come a long way, but I agree, there are definitely room for improvement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for everyone listening, I will definitely link the dietary guidelines for you to access if you'd like to check it out. It is a very long document, so there are certain pages that may stand out more than others, but if you'd like to check it out, it will be there for you. Now, Melissa, I know when we first started talking, you were working on your latest research that was about to come out, and it looked at the relationship between healthy and or trendy diets and the exposure to environmental toxins. What do you want the listeners to know about the findings and the recommendations from that study?
Yeah, certainly. I'd love to share a little bit more about that work. It just came out a couple of weeks ago, as you mentioned. So we're really, I'm very excited here to have this platform to share our findings with your audience. As I mentioned, I'm interested in that interrelationship of environmental chemicals and diet. And as I mentioned with phthalates, for one example, some chemicals, our exposure to these chemicals occurs largely through our diets. And there are some evidence-based recommendations for reducing your exposure to harmful environmental chemicals in your diet, but we don't yet have a really, you know, robust guideline to help people do that. What we know so far is that generally avoiding, you know, foods in plastic packaging or avoiding foods that come from cans and eating more minimally processed and fresh foods and also including organic foods can help reduce your exposure to certain chemicals. So I wanted to evaluate in my study whether or not things like the Dietary Guidelines for Americans or other healthy diets that we advocate for would help accomplish this goal, whether or not these healthy diets would help reduce exposure to a specific group of chemicals known as endocrine disrupting chemicals. So these are chemicals that either mimic or block our body's natural hormones. So I used data from something called NHANES, which is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, and it looks at a nationally representative sample of Americans. And so we took some dietary data and we evaluated how well people were following each of these healthy diets. We looked at the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, the DASH eating plan, which is the dietary approaches to stop hypertension, and the Mediterranean diet. So we looked at these three healthy diets and looked at how well they associated with people's exposure to these endocrine disrupting chemicals. And we found in most cases that eating a healthier diet had no association with exposure to these chemicals. So the healthier diet did not prevent exposure to these chemicals. It basically showed us that these chemicals are really widespread in our food supply. And, you know, just following our general healthy diet recommendations is not adequate to reduce our exposure. And in one important case, we saw that following these healthy dietary guidelines could actually increase our exposure to certain endocrine disrupting chemicals, and that these chemicals may impact our thyroid function. So that was just one example where we saw certain healthy diets could actually, you know, expose us to more of these chemicals. It just depends on, you know, the sources of those chemicals in the food supply, and then how people, you know, implement those diets. So there was a little bit of bad news there showing us that, that these healthy diets definitely are not a foolproof way of reducing our environmental chemical exposure. But, you know, the take-home message that I want to send to people is still continue following these healthy dietary guidelines. They are well-researched and definitely are, you know, one of our best approaches to preventing a lot of chronic disease. But what our study, you know, illuminated is that they're not helpful for reducing our exposure to harmful chemicals. So we have more work to do to, you know, figure out better guidance to help people reduce their exposures, or, you know, working to develop solutions to reduce the amount of these chemicals in the food supply to begin with, you know, changing our production practices so that we have a safer food supply.
Yes. And as you know, in the latest, the best news, you know, the U.S. News and World Report, they voted or based on their findings that the Mediterranean diet was voted number one in terms of health and sustainability. So I know some people will often be excited and then feel like there's doom and gloom when it comes to hearing findings that even though that they're trying to do their best, they have their intentions, they're eating healthy, that they're still exposed to a lot of the harmful toxins. What would you say to those people?
Yes, I totally can understand that we often feel like we're doing our best, but you can't always, you know, make everything perfect. And I think perfect is the enemy of good. So absolutely keep following those healthy dietary guidelines. There are other things that we know will help to reduce exposure to these chemicals. Like I mentioned, reducing the contact of plastics with your food. So if you can purchase something packaged in glass rather than plastics, that may help. Or, you know, if you are going to invest in new food storage containers, purchase glass ones instead of plastic. So those are practical steps. Also, you know, when possible, buying things that come that are not from cans. So if you have the choice to purchase a vegetable that's, you know, frozen in plastic, that often is much more preferred than, you know, a canned vegetable, because there's less migration in that frozen package of these chemicals from the package into the food. So there are some, you know, simple decisions that you may face where you can kind of optimize. So those are some approaches people can take. And again, which really mirrors our common sense nutrition approach, is eating less processed foods and sticking to more, you know, whole and fresher foods should definitely reduce the amount of a lot of these environmental contaminants in our diets.
Yes. And you had already mentioned about the Environmental Working Group's guide to reducing pesticides. So there is the Dirty Dozen and the Clean 15, which we will link in the show notes. And as you mentioned, you know, furniture. So that's, I think, where consumer awareness comes from. I know it's so hard. We feel like we have to research everything, but just sort of understanding when you're bringing in that furniture into the home, where is it coming from? How is it imported? And maybe what the material is made out of.
Yeah, it can be shocking all the places you might find these chemicals. Another key place is our personal care products. So the shampoos or lotions or cosmetics that we choose could be another big route of exposure to these chemicals. So choosing those products that, you know, are designated as free of phthalates, you know, or parabens can be another great way to help, you know, take a step in the right direction.
Wonderful. And if you have helpful links for people who will be purchasing items, I would love to include those as well.
Okay, great.
And Melissa, where do you see the future of food and nutrition research and their impact on human health? Well, environment health,
yeah.
I should say animals and humans.
Yeah. So I'm going to give you a biased answer of where I hope that my research is heading and where, you know, a lot of my colleagues, I hope, are heading. So what excites me about the future of nutrition research is looking at nutrition as one component of what we call the exposome. And that's a fancy term used to describe all of our exposures over a lifetime and how that relates to health. So that integrates, you know, our nutrition, the diet that we eat, the lifestyle factors, the environment around us, and how all of that together, you know, interacts with our own unique characteristics, our own genetics and physiology to impact our health. So like I mentioned at the very beginning of the episode, a lot of times scientists are working in silos and just looking at one or two things at a time. But I think it's important to look at all of these factors together and use the power of, you know, large data sets and, you know, big data research to look at the exposome and how all these factors together are influencing our health, the environment around us, as well as our diet.
Yes. And the effect of the research findings on policy. So that's
yes, absolutely. Positive. Taking it to the next step to help, you know, improve human health.
Great. And Melissa, where can our listeners find out more about you?
So I'm not extremely active on a lot of social media. But the, you know, the studies that we talked about today, that I've conducted since I've been at Seattle Children's are all promoted through Seattle Children's, social media. So I think that might be a great place, for your listeners, to get this type of information as it comes out from, you know, my research group and many others at Seattle Children's. So they're on Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram. You know, I can be found on LinkedIn and Twitter. So I can send those links to you too.
Perfect. I will provide that as well.
Okay.
Melissa, thank you so much for being here to share your knowledge, your expertise on a topic that affects all of us.
Thank you very much. It was an honor to talk with you and your audience today.
Thank you. And it's so refreshing to hear sound advice from a respected professional in the field. And we will definitely continue to follow your research and their findings.
Thank you so much.
And to the listeners, thank you for tuning in. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast with your host, Argavan Nilforush. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into all the tips and tricks you and your family can use to make daily life a little easier. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, share with others, and follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Baby Steps Nutrition Podcast. As always, you can head over to babystepsnutrition.com to sign up for our email list, as well as check out all the links and resources in the show notes. See you next time. Tune in. Feel great.